Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you. As we've been learning more about the NSA's surveillance programs and leaker Edward Snowden, we've been talking about freedom in America on The Takeaway and freedom's relationship to privacy. And July 4th is just around the corner, and while freedom is part and parcel of our concept of America and our democracy, Thomas Jefferson didn't include the word in the Declaration of Independence, the document we celebrate every 4th of July. It's not in there. Even still, as writer Jill Lepore notes in an article for this week's New Yorker, by the time the United States was founded in Jefferson's time, freedom and privacy were thought to be inherent in democracy. But this hasn't always played out in practice since long before the formation of this republic. Jill Lepore joins us from a studio at Harvard University, where she's a professor of American history. Welcome, Jill.
Hi, thanks.
Thank you for joining us. You talk about sort of the history of privacy and democracy, and what strikes me reading your article in The New Yorker, that there's really nothing new under the sun when it comes to our apparent struggle with privacy and freedom. This is an old, old argument.
Actually, I don't think I agree with that, Todd. I'm sorry. I don't think that the rhetoric of freedom is a big part of the conversation about privacy until very recent times. In fact, privacy has a fascinating history in that it's historically quite bounded. You can't actually have a notion of privacy before the rise of individualism, and privacy itself doesn't really become a catchword or even an aspiration until the emergence of a middle class, which happens after industrialization. So I guess as a historian, that seems to me very recent recent days.
And as a radio host,
looks longer ago to a radio host. I got to get myself out of the past and live more in the present, I guess, is
well,
the lesson here.
So what was the long view to me was 1844, and you describe in your
yes.
article the case of an Italian national. But in 1844, had his mail read in the United Kingdom. Now, to me, that's a long time ago. To you, it isn't, and I get that. But the example still stands. This goes all the way back to snail mail in 1844.
Sure, absolutely. And really, the mail is a big piece of the story here with the rise of privacy, because privacy really, since it's so closely tied to the rise of individualism, is also closely tied to the rise of literacy and the emergence in the 19th century of something close to near universal literacy. Think about how transformative that was. I think the digital revolution really pales by comparison when you think about what it meant for something that was utterly secret and privileged to a very few people, that is the ability to read and write, to suddenly become so widespread. Suddenly, you know, by in the 19th century, in the United States, where literacy really expanded quite dramatically over the space of a few decades, what was once secret, looked like a cryptogram to almost everybody, could suddenly be read by nearly everyone. And the mail was really the sort of thing that interrupted your privacy, that came through this slot in your door, these letters that were little containers, envelopes that contained some other self, some other person's very soul. And so the reading of the mail, this terrific story, I was fascinated by the NSA story because it reminded me so much of this Giuseppe Mazzini story from 1844, when this Italian revolutionary living in London became suspicious because his mail was always arriving late and the stamps seemed kind of funky and fishy looking. He became suspicious that the government was reading his mail, so he conducted an experiment. He put little grains of sand and strands of hair and poppy seeds in envelopes to letters he sent both to friends of his and to himself. And his friends got the mail and the stuff was still in it, but when we opened up his mail, there were no poppy seeds, no strands of hair, and no grains of sand. And so he went to Parliament and said, the government's been reading my mail. And it turned out he was right.
Now, was Mazzini a good analog to Edward Snowden? Are they similar in a way that you see?
No, they have nothing to do with one another in the sense that Mazzini was a longstanding political activist. He had quite courageously attempted to unify the kingdoms of Italy and form an Italian republic. He had been arrested many times. He had been sentenced to death in absentia, and he was living in exile in London. He was actually attempting to discover the nature of the secret, what turned out to be a secret department of the post office. He didn't know of its existence. He suspected it. It was the investigation that was launched as the result of a complaint that he lodged that led to Parliament forming a committee of secrecy that conducted an investigation that revealed, in fact, that there was a secret department of the post office, that opening people's mail had been done for centuries. It had been, this sort of historical report was commissioned that traced this practice back much farther in time back, Todd, than even you or I would be interested to know.
Would consider history, yeah. But you can certainly see the parallels, though, even though their methods were different, between, you know, the investigation that followed in this case and all of a sudden the public becoming aware that the government was reading mail for hundreds of years. and the compressed timetable of this scenario where even though it was a leaker, the public all of a sudden learns that the government has the ability to read emails going back at least till 2007.
And I think the other parallel that's really interesting is everyday people getting mail was a new thing in the same way that email is a relatively new thing now, or all the ways in which we use the internet that are being tracked. So it's in a sense the novelty of the problem that's a parallel between 1844 and today. And so there's a big debate in the 19th century about the very nature of privacy and the nature of what at the time was called publicity, which word meant at the time what we would use the word transparency for. So people in Parliament and political reformers made great claims for the need for publicity in the 1840s, that is to say, to make public what the government was doing. Some members of Parliament said, well, if the government's going to be reading people's mail, that's fine, so long as they notify us if they're reading our mail. You know, Disraeli said, I don't mind if the government reads my mail, so long as they would answer it for me.
Well, flash forward to today, Jill Lepore, and you talk about a culture where so much is public, so much is based on publicity, especially online, where people strive for publicity, putting their private thoughts and their private actions on public websites, and at the same time are obsessed with privacy.
Yeah, I mean, isn't the real story here not the NSA, but our illusion of privacy protection in a commercial and increasingly commercial experience on the internet? Right? Like, think about the ways in which we have yielded all kinds of what in another era we might have considered private affairs to that web that catches all that information, and how much we volunteer, we ourselves place on that web. So publicity today means attention that we seek out, right? Like the attention of the press or the attention that you get when you post something on Twitter. And we celebrate that. It's a driving engine of many people's days in a way that is really unimaginable, say, in the 19th century. So we have a very different relationship between privacy and publicity today than ever before.
Do you think maybe President Obama understands that when he sort of reassures or tells Americans, as he did in an interview last night, look, freedom is not on the ropes here. Everybody relax. We need security. But essentially, trust us, maybe he understands that just because the NSA is potentially listening doesn't mean it's actually any less private than things were before.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think what he's relying on is the trust that consumers have in the information that they disclose every second of every day to Google and Facebook and what have you, that there is a kind of passivity about what one yields up into the world. And if anything, I think he's maybe leveraging off that. And I'm not sure that's a good thing, but the two really can't be separated.
Jill Lepore is professor of American history and a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her article on the history of privacy and individual freedom is in this week's magazine. And we're hearing from you. What does freedom mean in modern day America? Steve from South Carolina tweets us that freedom is the ability to do what I want as long as I harm no one else. We want to hear your definition of freedom. Finish this sentence. Freedom to me is blank. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us, of course, at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.